right. Well, thank you very much for inviting me and allowing me to participate in this panel. Just wanted to state clear as day that these are strictly my own personal opinions and are not the opinions or reflected opinions necessarily of the Department of Defense, the Army Reserve, or the United States Army Medical Department. The following personal financial relationships, I have none. There's no conflict of interest on this topic. Okay. Basically, this is the outline you can read through that I'm going to go through and touch on a number of different things. But I just wanted to kind of give a little story of what prompted me to start doing a little more research on this topic. Last year, I was in San Antonio as a reserve officer attending the Army Medical Department's Captain's Career Course for kind of mid-career reserve officers from all across the medical specialty, surgeons, veterinarians, nurses, environmental health types, et cetera. And I was a bit struck because we were in a civilian setting, in a civilian university, and we were ordered to our feet by one of the instructors to follow along in a chant of close the distance, assume the dominant position, and finish the fight. And we said that at the top of our lungs three times. Now, I'm no shrinking violet. I'd spent some time, 2 years, as a medical platoon leader in an infantry unit up at Fort Drum, where just about every guy besides me who had a bar on his shoulder was an airborne ranger. So, you know, but for me, this was something new. And I just wanted to see what was happening within the Army Medical Department and what was happening within the larger Army. So that's what I'm here to share with you today. I just want to comment that my talk is very Army-centric. I have a number of wonderful colleagues here I can see and I've spoken with before who are with the Navy Medical Department who probably could answer and talk a lot more to that service. But I'm going to speak as best I can to just general broad trends. Not your father's medical corps. This is something that I'd given a full-length paper on in Boston at the American Public Health Association with Andrew Basevich, author of The New American Militarism and former commander of the 11th Armored Cavalry Regiment. But basically, this is I wanted to queue up a few slides to kind of lay the foundation for what I'm doing here. You see Hawkeye Pierce. That is kind of historically, at least in modern pop culture, the image of the Army Medical Department, or necessarily military healthcare in general. Part of the military, but somewhat separate and somewhat aloof. Some interesting things that many people may not be aware of. When the doctor draft was in place from 1950 to 1973, military medicine virtually mirrored, at least at the entry level, with the national graduating cohort of physicians. 94% of people who graduated during that time either served in the uniformed services or in the U.S. Public Health Service. And it provided a tremendous feedback loop to civil society and just a good cross-pollination between the larger profession and those under arms. There were very short terms of service, generally 2 years, that could be done after medical school, post-internship, post-residency, and post-fellowship, and ensured, again, a closer relationship with the ethos of the civilian professional and that of the military officer. Post-draft 73, there's been a chronic struggle to fill the required cohort of healthcare professionals. Having been and won my battle stars on the streets of New York as Army health professional recruiter, I do know that it's a very uphill battle. So to compensate that, the military has instituted a number of recruiting efforts for the healthcare professionals, almost entirely geared towards a financial need. And that's the full tuition health profession scholarship program, the Uniformed Services University of Health Sciences, as well as very, very generous loan repayment. But with this comes the lengthy service obligations that are widely used to keep personnel that do volunteer to serve in uniform for very long periods of time. And that can go, in one example I'll show, up to 17 years. So there's a tension there of long-term career viability as well as necessarily a closeness with the civilian profession. And there are some imbalances within some of the fields of what the civilian cohort looks like and what those in uniform look like. And just offhand, that's the large number of osteopaths and a regional quality imbalance compared to the eligible population. I just had spoken with the Deputy Director of Graduate Medical Education for the Army, and the full scholarship winners at the civilian schools are almost a full 2 points lower than the national average for the MCAT. And an accelerating trend towards insular, military-exclusive professional programs, and there's been a number of efforts in recent years to kind of close funding to allow officers to go outside of the Army to get degrees and cross-pollinate with their civilian peers. And those are just a few examples right there. Just a quick upfront, you can just see it, is the what I call the DO-MD split. I do not have the Navy numbers and the Air Force numbers, so I will not pretend that these speak for them. But you can see almost a gradual meeting of the osteopaths and allopathic physicians within the graduating cohorts and entering cohorts, actually, of military physicians. And on the bottom, it's important because less than 17% of all medical students nationwide are osteopathic students, but they almost become an equal number to the allopathic physicians. And that can be attributed to, I will tell you firsthand, recruiting efforts. There's a tremendous effort to visit and to offer scholarships to the osteopathic schools, which may have lower average MCAT scores and much more expensive and a much higher financial need. So these are just a few things I'm going to talk about three programs right now, which have kind of created insular, self-propagating pipelines into service. And one of them that I'd spoken about before is Uniformed Services University of the Health Sciences. This is kind of, this is the military's medical school, and it was established in 72, graduated its first graduating class in 1980. It's now spread broadly to a large number of programs to include MPHs and a DRPH. The university's stated goal is to produce career-oriented officers with 17 years of payback upon graduation. And the 17 years is calculated on someone who was, say, a West Point graduate, went to USUS, then became a surgeon, and that would be the payback. And since the 1980 inaugural class, a remarkable almost 80% of the graduates are still serving on active duty today. And they comprise 22% of the 11,833 active duty physicians, and the majority of those physicians serving in our special operations forces. And as we're seeing, as we get further away from the establishment of the school, they are disproportionately represented in the senior ranks within the medical corps. And they have also established a graduate school of nursing, and they also work clinical psychology PhDs, a DRPH, and an MPH. One of the other things they've done, to our great credit, and I will say I've served with a number of these people, and they are just absolutely exceptional, is the Inter-Service Physician Assistant Program. The Navy has not relied on this to the extent the Army has, but because of recruiting difficulties, we have very broadly inserted the PAs in positions that were formerly filled by physicians. 80% of the Army PAs are in deployable field units. They have tremendous autonomy, and they do a great job. But the only way into this program, at least in the Army, is to come from within the service and already had served 3 years either as an officer or enlisted. So it is a self-selecting group. Outside people interested in this cannot apply. And the other one, this is brand new, that just started this year, and this is the one that really piqued my interest, is the Army MSW program. Pick up any newspaper, turn on the news. We can very plainly see the great need for these types of providers, along with psychiatrists and clinical psychologists within the Army. I used to recruit social workers in New York City when I was in AMED recruiting, and I know what a challenging task it is to locate them. So what the Army decided to do was to create their own program, and it's a newly established MSW. The classes are taught in San Antonio at Fort Sam Houston, Texas, but the degree is granted through Fayetteville State University in North Carolina. It's an abbreviated 13-month program, and again, only open to people who are currently serving as active duty medical service corps officers. The option for them to, say, go to Boston University or to another school is foreclosed. They have to attend this one if they want to be a social worker. And I think prematurely, having actually done that as a recruiter, I think the Army concluded too quickly that it couldn't recruit qualified civilians without ever attempting to modify the strategy it used. I'd sold this program at Columbia, at NYU, at Yeshiva, and usually to very positive, receptive results. Will the in-house training trend continue? This is an interesting question. In the language in the Defense Appropriations Bill from last year, there was expressed an interest of creating a BSN program either at USUS or separately. Dental officer retention and recruiting within military-wide is extremely problematic and a tense issue right now. So a proposal could be offered maybe to offer a dental program at USUS, but nothing like that is on the table. There's an increasing reliance on the USU's MPH and clinical psychology programs by the Army's long-term health education and training program. An interesting thing is this year under this program, there will be no clinical psychology doctoral starts at civilian institutions for Army officers seeking the PhD in clinical psychology. They will have to attend USU's or they will not be able to pursue that degree. And then for the MPH, it's 6 starts at USU's and only 4 at civilian schools. And this gets to another thing that may unsettle some people in the audience, but I feel very strongly about having, you know, been the guy who was heckled. There is a law of unintended consequences. By limiting access of healthcare recruiters and the military to advertise opportunities at broadly representative national forums like this, what happens is it reinforces the notion that, well, they're not interested, we can't approach them, we have to grow our own. Now, what are some of the implications for the over-reliance on the programs? Obviously, it's the lengthy service commitments. This is a quote that came out of a Denver Post article from a brigade surgeon, a young officer, probably just out of residency in family practice or emergency medicine, talking about command pressure to increase deployable manpower and send patients for a 15-month tour that may or may not normally have been up to that. If you are looking at a 4-year payback and a 17-year payback or a 13-year payback, and you're in year two of that 13-year payback, there may be some type of conflict there. There just may be that hidden kind of pressure. And also, a limited to no contact with a larger civilian profession may lead to institutionalization and exacerbate to dual role conflicts. I think very easily we can talk about a military academy grad who goes to USU's to a military residency program, and their entire pipeline since high school has been in a uniformed military atmosphere.
Just the end of the quote, could you just go back?
Oh, how do you go back?
I'm not sure. Keep going.
Treatment.
You're
a physician.
Okay. Anyway, I know.
Sorry about that. Okay. This sets up to what I was going to talk about. And I just wanted to talk a little bit about some trends happening that at least I see, not only within the larger military, but also especially within the medical corps within the Army. I want to put out a disclaimer before I start this segment. This is strictly an examination of what has happened within the military. This has nothing to do with the many fine groups that, for example, the Wounded Warrior Project is a tremendous organization that helps so many returning veterans get back on their feet and support them financially. So please continue to support those groups as best you can, but this is strictly some of the administrative things happening within the military. In 2002-03, we really saw a trend of the use of the word warrior and warfighter to describe military members in ways that were unprecedented, quite frankly. Prior to that, you would see the word warrior, but it would be almost like a team name, the Warrior Brigade, you know, things of that sort. But this was really just to use that instead of soldier or troop or, you know, service member. And some people I've spoken with have said the term suggests a person who lives for wars. And the traditional role, which was mentioned at the War and Peace talk today, was, you know, we view our service members as civilians first and soldiers second. And with little to no debate, an ethos that we kind of held by for about 2 centuries has been kind of marginalized and replaced. The quote here at the bottom is from a retired Air Force colonel who's a pretty well-read military historian named William S. Storr. And this is just, I think, a very important quote. When we look at our troops, if we don't see ourselves, then we see aliens or worse yet, superiors, warfighters in need of support. And I think that's a very important thing to, you know, for the public and to identify with the military as of their own and have that concern. This message has been amplified extensively by defense contractors. And these were just a few things I picked up to see where some of this terminology is used. Lockheed Martin there on the bottom talking about their support of wounded soldiers and even to sell medical equipment, the DRAS shelter, the warfighter's choice, 1435 Zulu, critical trauma patient. One of the most emblematic things I can point to for if I was going to talk and show something to a civilian audience who maybe is a bit distanced from the military is the change of the soldier's creed. This creed is the one that I had learned in 1995 when I raised my right hand. And this was written after the painful aftermath of Vietnam. And this was a creed for the American soldier coming through basic training and coming through officer basic course to kind of live an ethos. And I just highlighted a few segments in here. I will always act in ways creditable to the military service and the nation it is sworn to guard. I will use every means I have, even beyond the line of duty, to restrain my Armory comrades from actions disgraceful to themselves and to the uniform, and I will try to make the people of this nation proud of the service I represent. November 2003, this was changed. This is the current Soldier's Creed, we first here see the word warrior appears not once, but twice, but also a change in the tone. Instead of a serve, protect, defend, we now see an offensive aspect. I stand ready to deploy, engage, and destroy the enemies of the United States of America in close combat. There's nothing short of that. You know, it's funny because if you read what, you know, General Petraeus and so many people with counterinsurgency doctrine are employing, it's the opposite of this. It's soft power. This is very important. There's no mention of restraint anymore. Following orders, obeying the law. I'm not saying that they're advocating not to do that, but it's telling in the language that's chosen to be used. And this has happened all through the United States Army. This is a great example. I mean, I cannot tell you the breadth of these kind of instantaneous, dare I say, Orwellian changes. This is Army Reserve Magazine from September 2002, now known as Warrior Citizen Magazine. Complete with a Leni Riefenstahl-inspired thing in front of the Capitol. And this is transferred over to Army Medicine. Walter Reed is now, we provide warrior care. When I go to the commissary, they salute me and say that, and you see the tone of language on the website and the Army Medical Department promoting and maintaining the health of the warrior. This has gone through the entire system, and, I think unity, service, and wisdom is the historic unity, wisdom, and service. I think is the historic title for Walter Reed, their motto. But that's the one they're using now. And one of the things I think this is more of inside baseball, but I think is very important to point out. And thankfully, this has not happened in the Air Force and the Navy. But is the removal from the field uniform of the outward marker of the healthcare professional within the Army. This is the old uniform, the green version you may have seen, the battle dress uniform, and this is the desert one called what used to be called the desert camouflage uniform. But on every healthcare professional officer's left collar was the symbol if they were a veterinarian, a dentist, a physician, environmental health officer, and so on and so forth. This was changed. You may have seen some people in the conference wearing this. This is the new Army combat uniform it replaced. And the branch insignia, the mark of distinction for the healthcare professional, no longer exists. And Dr. Jonathan Shays, who wrote two very good books, and I spoke to him on this topic, Achilles in Vietnam and Odysseus in America, his first response was, this really has an impact on the moral agency, in a deployed setting. You know, you are now just another captain, another lieutenant, another major. Thank you very much. And interestingly, the chaplain corps is the only branch that still is allowed to wear the branch. And there's you can see the crucifix there. This is just some quick Army names, 2002 and now, just how quickly this has changed. Just recently on the Department of Defense's public affairs news aggregator, military health care has now become warrior care. That just happened about 3 months ago. And there's a new look at the Army Medical Centers. I picked the president, not for anything about the president, but it just shows the change in protocol. For a similar presidential visit. This is the beginning of the war, 2003, and here we are today. And just a visual timeline of Purple Heart ceremonies going from Jessica Lynch to today. Quickly, and I will wrap this up, I promise, one thing I wanted to talk to you about was the warrior transition units. They have done many good things. This was an outgrowth of the horrific problems we saw at Walter Reed, where because of personnel shortages and just a completely overburdened system, young injured soldiers were really neglected. And so the warrior transition units were a swift response to the shocking conditions uncovered in the post. But one of the things that has not been discussed is the command and control of the patients were removed from the medical center staff. And some within the Medical Service Corps, myself included, perceived almost an implicit message to the force that non-combat and medical personnel were basically incapable of providing proper care and empathy for the wounded. I think the larger story was maybe there wasn't enough resources and with what we were trying to do. The warrior transition units, there's 36 of them in the Army, about 12,000 patients. Interestingly, only about 12% had actually been injured in combat, and 48% were combat-related, and because of the shortages through the force, we've had a difficulty recruiting. This is just a schematic I had just quickly done to show pre-warrior transition unit brigade, the chain of command. The patient and the uniformed clinician fell under the same chain of command, the medical center commander. So there was, you know, kind of a sharing of information. There were not stovepipes, and it was the same court-martial authority. Post this, you can see that there's two separate silos right now. The patient is known officially in an Army military personnel messages, warrior in transition, and falls under a chain of command of combat arms officers put into the medical center, whereas the clinical provider and the commander are in a separate part. And this is two quick case studies. One was in the Washington Post. This is Lieutenant Elizabeth Whiteside. She was a tremendous officer who had a psychiatric episode in Iraq, threatened to hurt another officer, and shot herself. Transported to Walter Reed as a psych patient, and the Warrior Transition Unit, separate chain of command, attempted to bring criminal charges against her, despite the chief of psychiatry and the commanding general of Walter Reed saying that this would not be good outcome for the patient. Ultimately, after the news broke, she was the charges were cleared, but this is an example of something that could go wrong. The other one here is at Fort Benning, home of the infantry, where the barracks for the wounded soldiers were built about 200 yards away from the firing ranges. About 15%, 10 to 15% of the patients had PTSD, and they had complained to the medical personnel about how this was exacerbating their problems. But again, because they no longer fell under the ownership of the medical community, they could not do much. This quote is from the commanding general of the Warrior Transition Unit. I can see how that would be a problem. It's something we haven't considered but should. So I have to wrap it up, but I dedicate this talk, as I did my last one, to the young men of the 2nd 14 Infantry, my unit that I had served in, and I greet a lot of these guys as young privates out of Fort Benning, and many of them were my patients, and rest in peace.
Thank you very much. We're going to need to go on. Maybe we'll take one very quick question if you have one. Just
yes, a little bit off the subject. Thank you very much. I'm a practicing clinician in San Diego, and the husband of one of my patients was a battlefield surgeon. He graduated from the Uniformed Services Medical School and was sent directly to Iraq for two tours before he did any residency. So let that remind you to the audience about the quality of medical care under the current stress and direction.
I just want to make that was probably a Navy officer who was supporting the Marines. The Army has stopped, they call general medical officers. The Army no longer uses GMOs to deploy units. Army Infantry Battalion has a board-eligible physician and a PA. But to my knowledge, most of the Navy supporting the Marines, they don't use the PAs extensively, so it's two physicians, and often one is what they call a GMO pre-residency.
Thank you very much. We're going to need to move on. Our next topic is human and health consequences of U.S. torture policy, to be presented by Leonard Rubenstein. Len is currently both president of Physicians for Human Rights, an organization for which he served as executive director for 10 years. He is also a fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace. Len?
Thank you. It's a real privilege to be here, and I want to express my appreciation to Vic and Barry for inviting me. I also have to wonder whether what I'm about to talk about is a consequence of what we heard about in the last talk. In discussions of U.S. policy on interrogation, the role of the vice president, the CIA, the black sites, and all that talk, we really rarely hear about the people who were the victims, those who were experienced what the United States did. But in order to do it, we need to give voice to them. We need to give voice to them because we need to understand the human consequences of U.S. policy, and we have to respect the dignity of people we abused as Americans. And we also need to do this to get a better understanding of the systemic issues that were part of the U.S. policy on torture. So what I'd like to talk to you today about is a report by Physicians for Human Rights, which we released in June, called Broken Lives, Broken Laws, Broken Lies, which is on our website. It was a result of clinical evaluations of 11 former detainees 7 of them held in Iraq, and the other 4 held in Afghanistan and then at Guantanamo Bay. These 11 men were willing to subject themselves to 2-day clinical evaluations, extensive interviews, psychological tests, and in one case, a review of the 1,200-page medical record from Guantanamo Bay. And those evaluations included both medical evaluations and psychological evaluations. I'll tell you about who these people were. The Iraqis were all arrested in 2003 during the first year of the war, and most were held for time ranging from a half a year to about a year. And they were held not only at Abu Ghraib, but at Baghdad Airport, Camp Buka, and other places. All the others, the 4 others, were arrested in 2001 or 2002 in Afghanistan or Pakistan, some brought in by bounties. They were first held at Kandahar or Bagram Air Force Base in Afghanistan, or both, and all of them were then taken to Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. All were released, and none of them were charged with a crime. Here's what we found. Overall, the soundbite conclusion is for these men, what they suffered was a horrific stew of pain, degradation, and suffering that endures to this day. As always happens when a government starts down the torture road, intelligence gathering gave way to a regime of widespread cruelty and destroyed the men and has demeaned our nation. In all the locations, most of the men were subjected to methods of interrogation and treatment, conditions of confinement, that were authorized at some time between 2002 and 2004. These included prolonged isolation, stress positions, temperature extremes, severe humiliation, sensory bombardment, use of dogs to instill fear, sleep deprivation, exploitation of phobias. They were all threatened, some with death, some with the rape of their wives, and for Iraqis, with transfer to Guantanamo. The horrors in these cases went on for months at a time in ways that are really hard to imagine until you read the cases. There are also differences between how they were treated in different places. In Iraq, almost everyone was forced to be naked for days, weeks, or months at a time, often in cold and dark rooms. In Guantanamo Bay, interrogation was accompanied most often by stress positions in which they were chained to the floor. 3 of the men in Guantanamo, 3 of the 4 were shackled to the floor for 18 to 20 hours at a time during interrogations. Also in Guantanamo, men were forced to take drugs not known to them, and medical personnel who offered treatment got caught up in the machinery of torture, either by patching them up for more torture or by being constrained in the clinical interventions they could make. These were all part of legal authorizations that we know about. We know, and I think it's important to understand the theory behind this. The theory is very clear. It actually derives from the Cold War research of the CIA, the idea that if you induce psychological regression, anxiety and disorganization of the personality, the resistance of the individual will decline, and the person will yield information. Putting aside the monstrous assault on human dignity that this represents, there is not a shred of evidence that this works except to accomplish the task of regression, anxiety, depression, and despair. But it became the standard of conduct. In fact, it has come to light in the past year that the standard operating procedure manual for Guantanamo Bay had the following instruction. The behavior management plan, which was under the control of psychologists, said that for each individual, that plan during the first 30 days had to have the detainee in isolation, quote, to enhance and exploit the disorientation and disorganization felt by the newly arrived detainee in the interrogation process, close quote, and exploit the men they did. But we found something else in this study as well, that the authorized techniques, many of which, of course, themselves amount to torture, begot yet additional forms of torture, proving once again that once torture starts, it cannot be contained. It undermines any form of discipline and authorizes cruelty. In Afghanistan, for example, beatings were especially severe among the men confined there, and this has been confirmed by other accounts of journalists. One man lost teeth, another had to be hospitalized after losing consciousness. They suffered enormous pain, which endures to this day. Two and possibly three of the men in Iraq were sodomized with broomsticks. The reason we say two, not three, is that the clinicians found evidence of a third rape, but the man would not talk about it. Two of the men were subjected in Iraq were subjected to electric shocks, and a third man in Afghanistan were pushed into a generator. And when I give you these numbers, just recall there were only 11 men. In Iraq, the men described an environment of gratuitous cruelty. One man was suspended by a winch, kind of like the rack. Another was stabbed in the cheek with a screwdriver. I think it's important to give voices to these men, and I just want to quote one of them about this experience, a man in Abu Ghraib. This is after the beating stopped. He said, after the beating stopped, they started trying to affect me psychologically. I was in a very small, dark room measuring about 1.5 by 2 meters, and I was totally naked. And the weather was very, very cold. And you don't have any blanket or clothes to wear. And I was sitting on the ground. And you don't know what there is on the ground. And you don't know where you were. And there's a very scary silence. The only thing you can hear is the voices of those who have been tortured at that time, the screams and cries. For all the men, and one of the most significant findings of the report is that for each one of them, the effects not only linger, but dominate their lives to this day. All of them suffer symptoms of severe anxiety, depression, and PTSD. Their social relationships have deteriorated. Their ability to work has declined. Their ability to sleep is very seriously impaired. During their incarceration, in fact, despite the Islamic prohibition on suicide, seven of the 11 men reported they attempted suicide or considered suicide, and three of them attempted it multiple times. Most of the others simply wished for death. I'd like to actually share, before I conclude, a fuller story of one of the men. We changed the names in the report for privacy reasons, and so we call this man Rashid. He was an engineer in his mid-30s and married with two young daughters, and was captured by bounty hunters in Afghanistan in April of 2002 and later transferred by the Afghans to U.S. custody, where he was brought to Bagram, where, as I mentioned, beatings were common. He was held in a cage for 2 weeks, and in one interrogation session, while hooded, he was beaten and kicked until he lost consciousness. He was then transferred to Kandahar. We were subjected to more hooding, more sensory deprivations, and more beatings. In June, 2 months later, he was flown to Guantanamo. And like other people brought to Guantanamo in this 22-hour flight, he was subjected to He couldn't move. He was shackled. His hands were in gloves. His eyes were subjected to goggles so he couldn't see, and his ears were covered. So he's unable to move and completely deprived of any sensory input for 22 hours. When he got to Guantanamo, according to the policy, he was put in isolation. He'd already, remember, been beaten very severely before he got there and subjected to lengthy interrogation sessions. Within 2 months, he had a psychotic breakdown. And this was the detainee, Rashid, for whom we had medical records. And those records confirm his own account that within 2 months, he started beating his head against the wall, talking gibberish, and attempting suicide. His interrogations didn't stop. And over the course of the first 3 years of detention, he had showed multiple acts of self-harm, including cutting himself, banging his head, self-hanging, and ingesting ice packs. The medical staff was called in, both physicians and psychologists. They didn't identify anything, in the medical records at least, anything relating his condition to the circumstances he was experiencing. There is no record whatsoever of any connection between isolation and other techniques used on him and his condition. In fact, in the last year, although his condition improved after he was removed from these conditions, his condition was described as suffering the, quote, routine stressors of confinement. One of the aspects that's very important to understand is that when the psychologist, he was begging to get out of isolation and also to talk to someone who spoke his own language. But the psychologist puts in the medical record, it's up to the interrogator to decide whether he gets out of isolation. So even to the extent that he was properly diagnosed and the clinical intervention was indicated, they couldn't do it. So we need to get to the bottom of this. Many of these practices have now ended, but truth, accountability, and concern for the victims have to be addressed. This has become a public health issue in the sense that we have thousands of people who are subjected to these kinds of treatments who have gotten no help, no rehabilitation, not even an apology from the United States. That's what the task is before us. And don't think it's going to be easy with the next administration, no matter who wins, because everybody wants to look forward, not to look back. I just want to end with a quotation from General Taguba, who did the original Abu Ghraib investigation, who wrote the preface to our report. He said, "There is no longer any doubt whether the current administration has committed war crimes. The only question is whether those who ordered the use of torture will be held to account." Thank you.